Welcome to History Edge, for students by teachers. This is a History Teachers Association of Victoria podcast, part of the Victorian Challenge and Enrichment series of activities and programs that are funded by the Victorian Department of Education. I'd like to start today by saying welcome back to all the VCE students who are tuning in. We hope you're enjoying this series so far and finding it helpful as you navigate your history studies. Please do let us know what you think. There are lots of factors that contribute to student success, and we know that one of the most powerful factors is the classroom teacher. In this series, I'll be interviewing history teachers whose students do particularly well in VCE based on the median class score. I should note that our interviewees would never claim to be the only reason why their students do so well, but here at the HTAV, we suspect that they know a thing or two about how to enjoy and succeed in VCE history, not just in exams, but across the whole year. They're here to share with you the guidance and advice that they give to their students about how to do really well in VCE history. We hope you find it helpful. For this episode, I'm joined by Victorian VCE history teacher, Paul Neefe. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you, Lauren?
I'm good, thanks, Paul. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Navigating this remote learning that we're still going through in Melbourne?
Yeah, I think everyone's in the same boat, aren't they? So it's been tough, but on students and teachers, but we're getting through it, and we're almost at the end of term three now. So we're moving toward the exam rapidly, but hopefully we'll be back in the classroom soon.
Fingers crossed. There's a light at that end, the end of that tunnel, that's just slowly starting to appear, I think. So fingers crossed. So before we get started into questions about studying history, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, Lauren, I've been teaching history now for the last 12 years, teaching history revolutions for 11 of those years. I've taught in the state system and the private school system. So I'm currently at Halebury College, and I'm the head of history there and the deputy head of humanities.
It sounds like a busy load.
Yeah, it is a busy load, particularly this year. But in that time, I've also been a history revolutions examiner. So for the last 4 or 5 years, I've been doing that. So I've got a little bit of an insight onto what the examiners look for.
Fantastic. That could be very helpful for us today. I should say that although you teach revolutions and will no doubt be talking about some specific strategies for this branch of VCE history, I'd just like to reassure our listeners that there will no doubt be some strategies for you all today. So keep listening, even if you don't, even if you're not studying revolutions this year. So Paul, we had a couple of conversations earlier, and we did discuss a little bit about approaches to study. You obviously see a lot of students having some significant success with their history studies.
Yep.
What are some of the approaches that they take?
I tend to find that the students that do best are the ones that obviously work the hardest. But, I mean, what do we mean by that term, work hard? And I think that's the thing that, you know, sort of sets an exceptional student from a student that might be, you know, a good student that, you know, gets okay marks, but what sets apart that student from the outstanding. And I think in the word work hard bracket, you're really looking at somebody who does a lot of practice at the actual skills that they will need in the exam. So if we're talking about history revolutions, we'd be talking about things like your document analysis tasks, your extended responses, and your essays, and really looking for the feedback on how they can improve on that. So I think there's two real parts to being a good history student, and that is obviously you need the knowledge, you need the base knowledge, and you need the specific knowledge, but you also do have to have those writing skills. And to be able to write well in a sophisticated fashion, you really do need to practice. So there's no real getting around that. And I think if you're a naturally gifted writer, then you can do quite well in this subject, but you also need to know your information. And, you know, studying timelines, key dates, names of people, places, statistics, they're all really important as well. But ultimately, the students that do the best are the ones that work hard, and they're the ones that do the most practice tasks. And importantly, I think doing it in a similar type of condition to the way it would be in the exam, So anybody can probably write an essay over 3 hours, but you haven't got that amount of time in the exam. So you've probably got about 30 minutes to write a good essay. So if you want to get feedback from your teacher, and it's, you know, accurate and realistic feedback, you really have to do it to the same types of conditions that you would have in the exam. So set yourself a, you know, 30-minute timeline or something like that to do a practice.
I think that would possibly be especially key. I know you said that those who have a natural writing ability will excel in history if they put in the hard yards.
Yep.
For those who perhaps have to work for their writing.
Yep.
Do we close? We're not closing the door now, are we? There's still.
No, absolutely not. No, absolutely not. I think one of the things that you can do as well, if you're somebody that perhaps struggles with your writing a little bit, looking at good sample responses can also really help. I think to get to the top of the mountain, you need to be able to see where the mountain is. And if you can actually look at, you know, some really good sample responses, there are some available in, for example, the examiner's reports that come out every year after the previous year's exam. They're
on the VCAR website, aren't they?
They are on the VCAR website, so they're accessible to anybody. So, and even if it's for a revolution or a topic that you're not actually studying that year, I think reading you're not so much reading it for the content, you're reading for the way that the sophisticated response will, you know, link back to the question, use sources and the way it uses sources, the way they embed quotes, and their expression, and how, you know, there's a difference between sort of comprehensive writing in terms of the way the question is approached and sophisticated. And that difference between comprehensive and sophisticated is probably the thing that a lot of students don't quite understand. I've got a lot of students that, you know, they'll get their 8 out of 10 and they'll say, well, what can I do to improve? And quite often it's just that level of sophistication. If they can't see how they get to that level of sophistication, they really struggle to understand what they have to do. So sample responses, some of the commercial organisations that publish sample exams and so on also have those types of sample responses attached to exams. But, you know, your teacher can also provide that for you. Usually, you know, more experienced teachers will have, you know, some of those samples they can give you. So if you ask, you might receive.
Never hurts to ask.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely never hurts to ask. And we'll try and make sure we've got a link to the VCAR reports in our show notes so our students can check them out. Because sure. I think, yeah, it's one thing to try and describe the level of sophistication that's needed to get those higher marks, but if you can see it and absorb it and even compare to your own and pick out what the differences are.
For sure.
Sounds like a great starting Absolutely. Point to me.
Yeah.
Now, we mentioned, so when we're talking about the skills in studying history, can you expand a bit more on that? Are you talking about writing skills or the analysis side of things?
Oh, well, it's a little bit of both. What I find is some students really struggle to understand the command terms and what they actually mean. So, for example, you know, what if you're asked to outline something or to explain, to analyze, to evaluate, these are all these command terms that are quite common in history and particularly revs. And understanding, you know, what's required in terms of those command terms is really, really important. The subtle differences between, for example, you know, analysing and evaluating, sometimes they can really cross over and they can mean the same thing. But obviously it does also depend on what the question is asking and how you tackle that. But certainly I find that, you know, sometimes students will really struggle to understand that command term, particularly if they're, you know, sort of middle of the road students, they can sometimes get those mixed up. So I think it's really important to practice a variety of those different skills with those command terms. So yeah, and you know, the analysis, looking at sources, you know, can you can you, particularly in visual sources, can you analyze a source within your writing without being quite narrative and descriptive of what
The narrative. That's always a trap, isn't it? Falling into that narrative.
That's right. And you just using, you know, the subtle messaging of the source perhaps, or, you know, symbology within the source, and embedding that into your, you know, into your response. They're all really, you know, key things that you see when you mark exam papers. The students that do really well, they do those sorts of things well as also.
So do you think it would be worth our students perhaps, if they were to look at these examiner's reports and even have a look at some previous exam questions, having a go at answering them and looking over their own work, perhaps comparing their answers to what's on the examiner's report, or even asking their teacher for feedback?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the one thing that I think that they that students have to do from here on in, particularly at, you know, when you're getting into this sort of revision period, is you must start doing, I know your school might offer you one trial exam, which you might do on site, but you can certainly do more trial exams in your own setting. So I certainly think that that is exactly what students need to do, is to do as many of those previous exams as possible. And yeah, use the examiner's report as a basis to, you know, look for feedback. But I don't think I've ever met a teacher that is going to reject a piece of work, an extra piece of work from a student who asks for a bit of feedback before their Year 12 exam. So,
well, there you go, guys. If you're listening, get some feedback from your teachers.
Hassle your teacher. That's what they're there for.
We love questions. I think we said that in a previous episode. We love questions. Hit us up. Paul, I remember you telling me in one of our off-air chats about some skills sessions that you run for your students, particularly in the lead up to the exam. Could you tell us a little bit more about what these look like?
It's funny because what I've been doing while we've been in the lockdown is been doing the skills sessions prior to the SACs, and the actual task that we do for the SAC are not dissimilar to what students will do in the exam. So a lot of it will be sort of repetitive on that. But I've been making a lot of videos for my students. So I'll get a set of questions and a set of sources if need be, and just sort of run through how I'd approach a particular question. So, you know, it'll be me if either live or on camera. I'm hoping that I'll be able to do some sessions live in term four.
Fingers crossed.
But it'll be really about me, you know, sort of displaying the question and saying, okay, brainstorming with the group, you know, what are the types of points that we can bring in here? What's the relevant information to answer the question? And going through some sentence structure with them as well, and really, you know, sort of like thinking about our expression and how we can make the most amount of points possible in the least amount of space, because one of the things that I think students really struggle with is that they've got a lot of things to say, but they might only have, you know, half a page realistically, or maybe a little bit more if it was a 5-mark question, to say a whole lot. So they really do struggle to, you know, get their points across in a succinct fashion. And
what advice do you give to your students when trying to help them get it down to the available space that they have?
I'm always at them to keep on linking back to the question or the contention that you're trying to argue. So instead of just going on if you've written two or perhaps three sentences without linking back to the question or your contention, I think you're getting to the point where it's becoming a narrative, and it's not linking. It's just sort of going in a, you know, sort of particular direction, probably a chronological order, and
a bit more storytelling.
A bit more storytelling. So I'm always saying to them, you know, use that language. You know, this was significant as it led to. You know, this was important. You know, a significant part of. You know, that type of language that is always bringing the information that they've just, you know, sort of written and expressed back to the question or contention, which the examiners really like, because you're always reminding them that you are answering the question and that you're not just writing information down and putting information down because you think that they want to hear what you've learnt throughout the year.
It's sort of like a little flag at the start of the sentence. It's like, hi, I know what I'm supposed to do here. You see, I use some keywords.
Yeah, that's right. The other thing that I really encourage them to do is to structure their response in a certain way. So, I mean, there's not one way to do this, but the way that I'd sort of approach it with my students is I like them to, you know, for example, if it was a extended response or it was a 10-mark question in a document analysis, I'd say, well, you know, set it up like a little bit of a mini essay where you have your introductory sentence and then you have, you know, some you know, maybe two or three key points that you want to make, but you signpost it, you know, using those signposting terms. You know, it might be as simple as firstly, secondly, finally, or, you know, furthermore, added to this, you know, so that the examiner really knows that you're starting a new point and that you've moved on from the previous point and you're starting a new point. It's easy to read. It flows. And I think one of the things that a really good skill to have is to be able to make your writing flow so that the examiner is able to read it easily. And if the examiner is able to read it easily, they are going to be in a better mindset when they come to giving you a score.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so I think that's one of the things in the skill sessions is, you know, practicing that structure and really getting them to try to stick to that structure. Now, obviously, they do need to think on the spot sometimes. You know, they'll definitely need to do it in the exam about their structure. So there might be some slight differences between the way you might structure a 10-marker in a document analysis that has the command term evaluate. You know, sometimes I get them to, it's a more, maybe a more open question where they can, you know, sort of look at the premise of the question and then.
Which bit was more significant?
Yeah,
which,
that's right.
Yeah.
You know, what was the significant and then the other factors that were significant. And you might have that sort of flip paragraph, you know, so that you might have two points.
What's a flip paragraph?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, where it's where you look at the premise of the question, you know, it might be the causes of the revolution. So, you know, the question might be something like evaluate the role of the Bolsheviks in, you know, the February Revolution of 1917. And obviously, you know, we want the students to think about the role the Bolsheviks played in that, but there are other factors that probably played a more significant role than the Bolsheviks. So you would, you know, you would potentially start off by, you know, having a paragraph that, you know, went through some of the things that the Bolsheviks did that was significant in the revolutionary or the causes of the revolution, but there were a whole heap of other factors. So your flip paragraph might be, you know, start off with your signposting term, however, and then you make a point of, you know, talking about some of the other significant factors. So that's a sort of a way that you can structure it. It's not the only way, but it's certainly something that the examiners will see that word, however, at the beginning of the second paragraph and think, okay, this is where it's evaluating. Great. So it puts them in that
looking
mindset.
At the whole picture, not just the tunnel vision.
That's right. The tunnel vision of what's written in the question and not thinking about the command term.
Excellent. We know that VC students, especially as we're getting closer to the exam, will be hearing a lot about the importance of historical skills.
Yep.
How should they balance the emphasis on the skills with the content understanding?
You can't have one without the other, and you certainly need to have an equal balance of both, I think. So I've had some students over the years that have been absolutely sensational writers. Their skills are outstanding, but then tend to perhaps not quite have the knowledge. And maybe they've got a good general knowledge, but might not have that insightful knowledge. You know, the insightful knowledge where you can pull out a specific date. You know, and by specific, I mean, you know, the actual date, not just sort of the month and the year.
Mm-hmm. So the details, the really fine details.
The fine details. So in that sense, you know, this is a student that's a good student. They're going to do pretty well. They've got the good writing skills. They're able to perhaps answer the question but might not have that finer detail. And they'll still do pretty well. And I think that that's some students are okay with that, and you know they might not get the perfect scores or you know the real high 40 scores, but you know they'll be okay with that. But certainly, I think that the skills are very, very important, and particularly that idea of answering the question. I get a lot of students that they'll submit a lot of work that has good, insightful information. They can tell you every date of, you know, the period of the area of study, every key event. They know names of people. They generally have got lots of information that they want to tell you about, but when it comes to actually being able to answer the question, they go off on tangents. They don't link back to the question. The historical language is not quite there. So, you know, just little things like, you know, for example, it could be that, or, you know, for example, in the Chinese Revolution, we've been talking about the idea of continuous revolution, which is sort of, you know, a policy that Mao, you know, implemented it after the revolution. And, you know, some students will call it continuous rebellion, or you know, they'll talk about peasant-based continuous revolution, which it just sounds a little bit clunky, and it's not sort of the textbook expression that would get used. So I think
proper jargon.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, that historical expression, accurate historical expression, just leads to that little bit more sophistication. So
I think that's great information for our listeners, that the historical skills that we're talking about, it's not just about being able to put pen to paper. It's not even just about that historical thinking, but it is about ensuring that you are answering the question and bringing your writing back to the question and using the right language and getting the details in there.
It's the last thing that I say before to my students before they walk in to the exam room every year is make sure you answer the question. It is so important, because the examiners will look at a response and they'll say, yeah, great, it's got all these dates, it's got all these details. This student is obviously somebody who loves history. They know everything about it, but they just haven't answered the question. And it's disappointing when you do see that. So they do have to think about that. And
for the students who are listening who might be thinking, oh, that's me, I know I've done that in the past, what can they do to try and stop that from happening?
As I said to you before, when I encourage my students to always be thinking about linking back after, you know, every two or three sentences, you know, think about linking back to the question, I think that the easiest thing, particularly somebody who might have that problem, is look for the wording of the question and bring the key words that are in the question into your linking sentences. So you should never really finish a point or a paragraph without linking back to the question or to the contention that you're trying to get across. So you think about it, you think about end of point or end of paragraph must link back. And if you've got that trigger that you have to write that link sentence at the end, at least that, you know, you might not do it as much as you need to, but there's nothing worse than reading through a response and it never actually brings up the premise of the question again, like after a full...
Especially when all that effort's gone into it.
Yeah, that's right. And you just think, oh, if you just had have linked that back to the premise of the question a little bit more, you know, it would have gone probably from being maybe a mid-level response to, you know, sort of a higher level of response. So I think that's the thing that I'd say is never end a point or a paragraph without linking back to the question or the contention and use the wording of the question in your response.
I think that's some really great advice. I think hopefully our listeners will be able to apply that strategy. I think that's a really strong one. Heading back to content, because I know you said that you've got to have a really good balance of content and skills, and it's all very well to have all the knowledge but without skills and vice versa. How can students organise their content knowledge? Assuming that they're doing a bit of extra reading and they're trying to take it all in, what can they do to help themselves out?
It's really hard for teachers to dictate to students how they should try to remember information, because I think every student's different, and it's really difficult to sort of say, oh, you know, put timelines up and, you know, put them on the walls of your bedroom and all those sorts of things, and Some that'll work for some kids, but for some kids it won't. So I think students have got to really think about their own learning, and they've been at school for a while by the time they get to this stage. So they should really know what works for them. And I would say that as a teacher, you just be supportive in the way that, you know, that they want to revise that information. So if it is timelines or it's mind maps, we do a lot of quizzes in class.
Okay.
So yeah, we have a weekly quiz, and there's a bit of a prize at the end of the term, you know, for the person who wins the most quizzes. It's a little bit of fun, you know, and it's basically based around facts. So quite often it's amazing how the person that quite often wins the quizzes is not the best student in the class academically in terms of their results.
Really? What do you think it is?
Well, quite often they're the student that knows a lot about the revolution but might not be the best writer.
Okay.
So I think, you know, quizzes can obviously help. If you're a really good writer and you want to improve your knowledge, you know, do as many quizzes as you can. And again, you know, there are quizzes around. You know, they're not hard to find these days with the internet. But, you know, mind maps, timelines, I've always said to my students, I said, there's, you know, the trick around learning dates is, and the shortcut around learning dates is that you just have to look at the date over and over and over again until
it's stuck.
You remember it.
Yep.
That's right. And it's stuck there. So there's no real other way to get around that. So it's just repetition, and sometimes it can be laborious, but if you do want to do well, you do need to do it. Some students are really, you know, really good readers, and, you know, they find that quite a good way to retain information, but there are other students that are not great readers. And, you know, in history, as we know, you've got to do the reading. There's no real way to get around it. But, you know, having said that, podcasts, videos.
Like this one.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So, you know, there's plenty of those around as well now.
Lots of video resources on YouTube.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So even, you know, like, I don't know, if you're sort of sitting down at night, instead of, you know, putting Netflix on, you know, listen to a podcast and make a few notes and, you know, in the lead up to your exams.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think I love the idea of the quizzes. And I just wonder if for our students who are listening, who's perhaps their teacher doesn't run those quizzes, perhaps they could start their own quiz group or ask their teacher if they could set them up once a week and take turns.
And it's not that hard, actually. When I first started, I gave each student a different section of the revolution and said, come up with 10 questions. And,
oh, okay.
And I said, the only proviso is that the it has to be based around a stat, a date, a name, a place, and a quote, you know. So it had to be factually based question. You couldn't sort of say, you know, it couldn't be a question like, you know, what was the cause of the Russian Revolution?
Yeah.
You know, it had to be, you know.
Yep, set in stone.
Yeah, that's right. So, and then all of a sudden, you know, if you've got a class of 15 or 16 kids, well, you've got 16 quizzes there.
Beautiful.
So if you're doing, you're doing a quiz, you know, once or twice a week, it's going to last you for a fair while.
Well, there you go, guys. That's your quiz parameters set. Get to it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so ask your teacher, you know, can we do something like that? I know a lot of teachers now use Kahoots and, you know, those types of things, which are great. You know, and there's already, I think with Kahoot, I've used Kahoot a few times, but probably not as much as some of my younger counterparts. But there's a lot of quizzes that are already there online that you can steal and take for yourself.
Check them out too.
Yeah,
definitely. Now, you did mention dates in there. With the Russian Revolution, I've heard some students mention that the calendar can sometimes be a bit tricky.
Yeah.
What advice do you give to your students about navigating that?
Yeah, I just say to them there'll be two dates in the pre-revolutionary period, and if you use either one, it'll be fine.
Okay.
So if you want to use 9th of January 1905 for Bloody Sunday, or the 22nd of January, the examiners won't.
Should they try and be consistent throughout and pick one sort of set? Or
look, ideally, you probably should try to, But it's not going to be a huge issue, I don't think, in any context when you're writing, and it's certainly not something the examiners have ever discussed. You know, so whether you refer to it as the March Revolution or the February Revolution, it's not going to matter. The examiners are fully aware of the situation, and you'll be fine with whichever one. So that'd be the least of your worries, I'd imagine. If so long as you've got one of the dates, you're fine.
Fantastic. Let's zoom in on the exam. What do you think are some of the, or what, where would you start if you're talking about the exam with your students? Where would you like to start talking about that?
I think that you've got to be really familiar with the structure of the exam, particularly with REBS, because you've got the four revolutions in there and you're only going to be doing two. So you've got to understand that you choose the section of the exam that
that you studied.
Yep. Now, I know there is, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether, you know, school teachers should be sort of dictating to the students which section of the exam that they should do. And ultimately, it'll be up to the student on the day. But generally speaking, most schools, I think, encourage to do one section or the other for each revolution. So if you've got that pinned down, you straight away, what you're doing is, you know that you're doing Russia section A and say China section B. You are in your reading time when you walk in there, you only have to read half the information because you're not going to be making a choice. You're just going to go with that. So I think understanding the structure of the booklet, knowing how to navigate the booklet, where your particular sections are located, and certainly the structure of the booklet hasn't changed in this study design period. So you can look at previous exam papers and they're all set up the same. So that shouldn't be an issue. Knowing also the structure of the exam book answer booklet is really important because you do have to write on particular section of the exam in a particular section of the answer booklet. I've seen a couple of examples when I've been marking of students who seem to have messed that right up and they've doubled up on started answering a different section of the exam in the wrong section of the booklet. The way, you know, the booklets are scanned, so it's all marked on the screen. So it's really, and we only get half the paper at a time. So if that happens, it can create issues.
Okay.
So
really definitely something to be aware
definitely
of.
Definitely you must have become very accomplished at navigating the exam booklet. So if you haven't started doing that already, I just suggest that that you do that. And certainly the old exam papers are there online at the same place that you get the examiner's report. So that'd be the thing that I'd certainly do straight up. And I have just recently really looked at the exam with my students and gone through that. The other thing that I sort of talk to them about is timing.
Oh, this is a big one.
Yeah. So the timing of each section. So ultimately there's two sections of the exam, you know, one for each revolution, but then there's two tasks within each section. So section A, you're doing a document analysis for the pre-revolutionary period and the extended responses for the post-revolutionary period. And then in section B, your second revolution, if you like, you're doing an essay for the pre-revolutionary period and then a document analysis for the post-revolutionary period. So really understanding the order of how that works is really important. And the timing, you know, two-hour exam, 30 minutes each, they're all worth the same amount of marks. And roughly speaking, it should take you about the same amount of time. So I sort of say, look, it's got to be about 30 minutes for each section. If you hit the 30-minute mark, you've really got in the exam, you've really got to watch the clock. If you hit the 30-minute mark, you really need to sort of wrap it up and move on, because once you get behind time in a REVS exam, you know, it's
hard to get back.
Yeah, really, really hard to get back. The other thing that I also emphasize is the idea that your reading time in that 15 minutes is really, really important, because you'll read your sources, you'll read the questions, but you can already be, you know, starting to think about how you're approaching those questions and you're structuring it up in your mind. I prefer to use the term thinking time rather than reading time.
That definitely sounds more actionable.
Yeah, exactly. And it just really gets your, I think a lot of students, they get in there and they're like, right, let's read the question. Let's read the sources, have a look at the visual. And then it's sort of like, okay, done that. And then they don't really think about how they're going to hit the ground running. They can already be thinking about those two first five markers in the first section of the document analysis, and they can almost have it answered in their head. And I think if they can hit the ground running, you can actually maybe finish that first document analysis maybe with a couple of minutes to spare, and that just gives you another couple of minutes to, you know, focus on the next section of the exam, you know, the next task at hand.
Absolutely.
And you don't feel that pressure as much with the time. So timing's really important. Reading time's really important. If you're a student that knows you write a lot and you might, you know, get through the exam answer booklet, so, you know, we run out of pages, mm-hmm. You know, asking for a second booklet early.
Mm, that's a good idea. And it's done.
Yeah, putting your hand up, you know, when you know that, you know, you're already on your last page, but, you know, not waiting until you've exhausted all the pages of the booklet and then putting your hand up, and then
every second counts, and you don't want to be sitting there waiting.
The invigilator comes down, then they've got to go back, get a booklet. Yeah, exactly. So just little tricks like that, you know, particularly for your higher end students who are looking to do really, really well, I think is really important.
Set yourself up from the start.
Yeah. And the other thing too is, you know, some students say, oh, you know, I wouldn't mind doing the essay last. Should I do it out of order? I'd say that's not a bad strategy, doing the essay last, because if you do run out of time, you can write a pretty good short essay and still, you know, not be as penalised as much with losing marks, whereas with maybe the document analysis, if you only get through half the 10-mark question, it's going to look pretty short. It's not a bad strategy, but just really be careful. I wouldn't be doing anything other than maybe doing the essay last. Then
don't rearrange it too much.
Yeah, don't rearrange it too much, because it can become really confusing and you can forget what you haven't done. And, you know, you get to the end and go, oh, I haven't done that A question. So, you know, once you start a question, finish the question. Just be careful about doing it out of order. So maybe doing the essay last is okay, but certainly not.
Keep track of it.
Yeah, exactly.
So with the document analysis and the 5-mark questions, I know it can be hard sometimes. You've got so much to say.
Yep.
And you really want to dig into that source and get the meaty bits out of it. How can students do that succinctly? Any advice?
I think, yeah, you've got to, I mean, so if we're talking about the sort of the outline command term, which is the first 5-marker in the document analysis. I mean, it's easier to keep that succinct because theoretically you do have to provide some context, so your own knowledge in terms of context, but you don't necessarily have to explain it or link it as much as what you would an explain question. So that's a little bit easier. When it comes to the explain command term, which is usually that second 5-mark question, that's where it can become quite difficult. And that, I think that really comes down to your planning. Spend 30 seconds or maybe even a minute, you know, you haven't got that much time, but, you know, 30 seconds just thinking about, okay, how am I going to structure this? How am I going to make two or three clear points that's going to answer this question? So I think that's really important. If you just start writing, that's where I think a lot of students get into narrative, and then they think, oh, you know, holy hell, I've written half a page already and I'm on my first point.
And I've lost this time.
Yeah, exactly. So they get to the end and it's like, I've only made one point and I've wasted all that space and all that time. So, you know, working out how you want to structure that response first.
The plan is an investment.
That's right. And you've got your pen there, you know, you can write in the question booklet. So you can do a little bullet pointed plan there and then you can move on. So I think it's in the planning and thinking about how you're going to respond to the question.
You touched on using your own knowledge to provide context there.
Yep.
I have heard from some students that they stumble when it says use your own knowledge. What does that mean? Is that asking me for explicit facts that I can just punch in there that I know that aren't in the source, or is it Can you expand more on what you were saying there?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it definitely does mean that you do need to bring in, you know, your specific evidence, if you like, and so on. But it also means, you know, for example, if it's a question about, let's just use the causes of the Russian Revolution again as an example, you know, if it says, you know, asks you to explain the role that Lenin played, and, you know, the source might be focused on, you know, it could be focused on Lenin's What Is to Be Done, you know, which was a document that he wrote, you know, very early on. Well, you know, What Is to Be Done was one element of the long-term cause of the revolution potentially, but of course Lenin did, you know, some other things. He brought in, you know, peace, bread and land and, you know, sort of the April thesis and did all those things in 1917, which helped, you know, create the revolution, which wouldn't be in the sources.
Mm. So I suppose it's sort of, it's looking at that sort of blending the significance of the source perhaps with other interplaying factors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the significance of the source is important. So you're looking at, okay, I'm making a point here about how he adapted Marxism and brought, you know, sort of the, you know, his own revolutionary ideas into the revolutionary story, and he created the split with the Social Democrats and created the Bolshevik Party, which was one long-term cause of the revolution, but not in the sources. The other factors that, you know, came to play as well. So I think that you've got to, when it says own knowledge, it's not just sort of saying use the sources and then bring in some extra evidence. It's saying, you know, what other factors, how are you going to answer this question? Answer the question first and then maybe bring the source in as a supplement to that. Sometimes, you know, sometimes the sources actually tell, you know, provide a pretty big picture in answering the actual question. And that's okay because you can, you know, pick bits of the sources, you know, or source or sources, depending on what the question is and how many sources they ask you to refer to. You can pick bits out as you need them. But if it says own knowledge, I think there's an expectation that you introduce something new, a new point that's not particularly related to the sources. So, it does depend on what the sources are, obviously. So, I'm just giving a very general overview of that.
No, I think that's great. It's insightful and it's helpful to have that that information and that insight into how to approach those questions. So thank you very much. I think we've pretty much worked through most of my questions without me even, like, we've just gone through it on our own, which is pretty great. Yep. Here we go. Exams. Are there any common mistakes that students need to watch out for?
Yep. So I've already touched on the timings, and I think that's a common mistake. So sometimes when we're marking exams, we see great responses to document analysis tasks, for example, which might be the last thing that they do on the exam, and then it's just a really, really good start, and then there's no end to it. So they've run out of time. So it really limits, you know, it might have been tracking for maybe an 8 or 9 out of 10, and then they're sort of limited to maybe a 4 or a 5.
Okay.
Which is disappointing. It's disappointing to see because, you know, they've obviously run out of time. Maybe they've spent a little bit too much time on the essay or one of the other sections and they've, you know, got into the flow and they've lost track of time. So that's a common mistake. The other one I think is, you know, students get into the exam and the adrenaline's pumping a little bit. And they really want to show the examiners what they've learnt throughout the year, and they just go overboard with the detail and the story.
Tricky one to balance.
Yeah, tricky one to balance. You really want to put that quote in that you spent that time learning, but
if it doesn't fit,
the quote might not fit. And that's the other thing I think is that you can't remember every quote. So, you know,
pick a variety.
You've got to pick a variety that can be used in a general sense in a variety of different contexts. And, you know, you're not going to use all of them. You know, there's that temptation to try and use all of them or use the particular dates and stats that you've got in your brain bank. So, you know, trying to put too much in can often lead to that narrative and being quite descriptive. But there's the importance of handwriting.
Ooh, that's a good one.
You know, some it's it's really frustrating as an examiner and as a teacher, and I'm sure you know as well, you know, like when you have a student that doesn't have great handwriting, and we still handwrite our exams, and if the examiner can't read it, they're going to struggle to give you a score that's going to to mark it. So really, if you've, you know, buy yourself a decent quality pen if it's if you need to. If that's the issue, sometimes you get a, you know, that sort of scratchy writing that that can sometimes be really hard to read, particularly on a screen. So, you know, that is frustrating. And I think if students just maybe practiced a little bit more, you know, and it's not necessarily confined to just students who, you know, struggle or might be perceived to be, you know, sort of lower end students. I've seen some really, really high end students with poor handwriting. So, and that's really
find a style that works for you.
Yeah, that's right.
And practice.
For sure.
I think that's some really great advice. Make it easy to mark, keep it neat and legible, but also balancing that those details with responding to the question and making sure you're doing the analysis or the discussion as well.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Fantastic. This brings us pretty much to the end of our interview, Paul. So, Paul, when you look over the years and your years of teaching, is there anything that you can pinpoint that your highest achieving students have had in common?
Yep. Work ethic.
Oh, good one.
I've never had a I've never had a student who I could say was just a natural and could, you know, go through the year and achieve their very, very best without that work ethic. I've had some exceptional students over the years that have been naturally gifted, but probably haven't worked as hard as what they could have, and they tend to get found out. And now I'm not saying that they're, you know, they totally bomb the exam, but I sort of think, you know, well, you got a pretty good score, mate. You know, you probably got maybe 4 or 5 marks less than what you could have, though. So, you know, you could have been a 48, 49 student, you know, study score, and, you know, you got 42 or 43. Well, that's okay. And they're, you know, probably going to be pretty happy with that. And like a lot of kids would just kill for a score like that.
Oh, absolutely.
But if
you've got the potential.
Yeah, you just think if you wanted to, you could have worked harder. So I think, you know, over the years, it's always been the students that have got the work ethic that really achieve their very. I had a girl a few years ago who throughout the whole year was, you know, battling away. She was getting a sort of 7 or 8 out of 10. You know, a lot of students would be really, really happy with that, but she just, you know, she just couldn't quite get that expression nailed down. But by the end of the year, she'd done that much practice and she'd worked so, so hard at trying to improve. And she, you know, she got a study score that was, you know, well into the 40s, and it was totally over her expectations, because her SAC scores were sort of sitting at around that 39, you know, 40, but, you know, just on that fringe, and, you know, that threshold of getting over 40 is what everyone talks about, isn't it? So, you know, that's sort of the bar that everyone wants to get over the top of. And, you know, her work ethic was just outstanding. And she, you know, she was over the moon with her result, but she was the one that worked hard.
So that work ethic and really putting in the practice.
Exactly.
Getting the feedback,
making sure that you're putting in the time to do the actual task that you will do in the exam, not just, you know, sitting out and typing up a response and sending it through, that, you know, a response that you've worked on for perhaps an hour with all your textbooks open in front of you and all your notes. You know, well, that's not really realistic at this time of the year. You have to try and work without those aids. So, you know, it's those students that will really be diligent at doing those sorts of things are the ones that inevitably get rewarded.
That makes perfect sense. And it's lovely to hear that it's not all about natural ability. It is about putting in the hard yards. And I think that makes it far more equitable and more, in a way, while students may not want to hear it, more achievable. Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the natural ability is, you know, something that helps. You know, some students are not naturally gifted, but, you know, that everyone's different. That's the reality. But the other thing that I say to students as well is be realistic with your aims, what you want to achieve. So I think if you're realistic with your aims of what you want to achieve at the beginning of the year and having those short-term goals and, sort of the long-term goal of what you want to achieve at the end of the year, if you're realistic, you quite often are rewarded. But you've got to be realistic, and you can't just sort of say, I want to get over 45 when, you really haven't, through your lower years of schooling, you haven't sort of really been at that level. Mm. Keep it realistic. As a teacher, I get more joy out of seeing a student who is in that mid-range, perhaps overachieve and get a really, really good score. Overachieve is probably not the right word, but, really achieve to their full potential because they've worked hard. I get more joy out of that. There, and they might get 38 or 39, study score, but perhaps, at the beginning of the year you were thinking that they might have been a low 30s. That gives me more joy than, seeing somebody get a 45 where they could have probably,
done a bit more.
A higher score, yeah.
For sure.
So definitely as a teacher, we always talk about the over 40s, but really it's that value add across the board that's really important.
Absolutely. Well, that's a lovely way to finish our episode, I think, Paul. So I'll just say a big thank you to Paul Neef for joining us. We really appreciate your time today. We know it's not easy during remote learning. And a big thank you to our listeners as well. We hope you've enjoyed tuning in. And for more information, please check out our show notes. Be sure to listen to the rest of the series as we collect more advice from the teachers of some of the highest achieving history classes around Victoria. This podcast is supported by the Victorian Department of Education, and they would love to hear what you think, as would we. Please do take the time to complete the evaluation form to assist us in developing further resources for VCE history students.